Hi, Keri Phillips here. Thanks for downloading Rear Vision. This year, the United States has made a kind of peace with two of its old enemies, Iran and Cuba. In this podcast, we'll find out about the Iran nuclear deal and its consequences for the relationship between the two countries and the Middle East.
After years of talks and weeks of intense negotiations, a deal over Iran's nuclear program has finally been signed. Almost in unison, the leaders of Iran and the United States deliver the news to their nations. I'm happy, the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani declared, that after 23 months of negotiating with the main six powers of the world, today we reached a turning point.
It's now more than 50 years since President Kennedy stood before the American people and said, "Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate."
The deal reached in July this year was, on the surface, designed to limit Iran's ability to make nuclear weapons in return for the lifting of crippling economic sanctions. But as we'll hear on Rear Vision today, it also signals a larger political shift in the region, one which could bring further instability to the area. Iran's first nuclear reactor, supplied by the US, began operating in 1967. A year later, Iran signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, opening its program to inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency. In 2003, the IAEA launched an investigation following the revelation that Iran was covertly running a uranium enrichment program, which could lead to the development of atomic weapons. In the following years, UN and EU sanctions were added to those that had been imposed by the US following the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Negotiations over Iran's nuclear program remained unresolved until the election of Hassan Rouhani as president of Iran in June 2013, which was shortly followed by a historic phone conversation.
A US president has spoken on the phone with his Iranian counterpart for the first time in 30 years.
The very fact that this was the first communications between an American and Iranian president since 1979 underscores the deep mistrust between our countries, but it also indicates the prospect of moving beyond that difficult history.
A few weeks later, negotiators from Iran and the P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom and the United States plus Germany, met in Geneva. Dr. Pejman Abdolmohammadi from the Middle East Centre at the London School of Economics says that many countries were keen to explore commercial possibilities in Iran and wanted to see the sanctions lifted.
Obama's direction towards the Islamic Republic of Iran is based on a compromise and trying to have a dialogue as much as possible. Instead, for example, the Bush administration, which was basing very much on a more harsh policies. So we have also seen that from the European countries, which also they have been lastly involved, they have a very much economic and commercial and trade interest, particularly Germany, Italy, and France, and United Kingdom, of course. Also, because there is an important interest as Europe in economic crisis, opening this enormous market, which is Iran, and which has been closed, it has been, you know, pushing them to do that.
Iran wanted the sanctions lifted for more than economic reasons, according to Robert Olson, a professor of Middle East history and politics at the University of Kentucky.
As you know, this is a big debate among scholars, both in Europe and the United States, as to what played the major role. And I think the consensus that sanctions have played a very important role. But were they the determining factor or not? I don't think so. I think that one of the things that was very important for Iran is its own domestic situation, especially after the 2009 riots against the government. I think that caused the Iranian government, the Islamic Republic, to stand up and take notice. Certainly the dissent from young people, from other geographical sectors in Iran, that they should move forward, to the point that probably they thought that their hold on government would be weakened. I don't say jeopardized, but certainly weakened. And I think those were the major factors.
While the US sanctions prohibit almost all trade with Iran, the EU and UN sanctions included bans on Iranian crude oil and natural gas and a ban on transactions with Iranian banks and financial institutions. Faradeh Fahi, an independent scholar, is an affiliate at the Department of Political Science at the University of Hawaii.
You know, part of the reason that United States was successful in its sanctions regime against Iran was the agreement of the Russians and the Chinese. United States was really able to create a coalition to put pressure on Iran. But at one point, the Russians and the Chinese made it very clear to the Americans that they are no longer willing to go further than this. So, and I think that was a very important component of the fact that an agreement occurred.
Can you give us some feel for the sanctions, what they actually were, and the effect that they've had on Iran?
Well, the sanctions on Iran were perhaps the most comprehensive sanctions ever imposed on any country in the world. What was different in relationship to the sanctions on Iran was a complete financial sanctions on the country, which in many ways was unprecedented. Iran's central bank was placed under a sanctions regime, so even if the Iranians could sell some of their oil because of the exceptions that were allowed, effectively they could not transfer the revenues from the sale of oil to the country. So the only way one can describe the sanctions regime on Iran is extremely coercive and exactly like a noose that was gradually tightened around Iran's neck. In fact, part of the reason that the sanctions regime was so successful was because it was done gradually, one step at a time, and it effectively led to an incredible contraction of Iranian economy. It was a kind of sanctions regime that, although presumably directed at the leadership in Iran and the Iranian nuclear program, it effectively held the Iranian population hostage.
Trita Parsi, the president of the National Iranian American Council, says that despite the sanctions, Iran had continued to make progress towards nuclear weapons.
What happened on the American side was a realization that the sanctions actually were not sufficiently effective, because there was an sanctions clock and then there was an Iranian nuclear clock. The Iranians responded to the sanctions by accelerating their nuclear activities. And they accelerated their nuclear activities faster than the West could cripple Iran's economy. So if that race had continued, the Iranians would either get a bomb or the US would have to bomb Iran, because the sanctions would not be able to cripple their economy before they reached a bomb. And as a result, the administration needed to find an exit, and they needed the Iranians to negotiate.
But the relationship between Iran and the US had been poisoned by events like the CIA-backed coup that overthrew Iran's democratically elected government in 1953 and the Islamic Revolution of 1979, when 52 Americans were taken hostage. Dr. Beyza Ünal is a research fellow at Chatham House in London.
There was no trust that was built among the parties, because after 1979, when the Shah fell down and the Iranian regime changed, the United States did not engage closely with Iran. The second challenge, if you ask individually about the deal, is a domestic challenge. There was this Iranian hardliners, which is the conservative side, who were totally opposed to the deal. And likewise, in the United States, the Senate was seen as one of the challengers to the Iranian deal. If you ask where the European Union lies in this, in the public, there was not much saying over Iran's nuclear program or nuclear weapons program. So there was no much opposition in the European public, I would say. U.S. Senate and the Iranian hardliners were the main problem domestically.
Well, part of the reason why this took a very long time is, A, it was a very complex issue. This was not an easy thing, in the sense that there's a lot of details that had to be sorted out, because if you put all of this time and investment of political capital into a diplomatic solution, you want to make sure that it is going to be a lasting solution. You don't want to negotiate a deal that falls apart a year from now because there were various eventualities that you did not address in the deal. This deal has addressed almost every eventuality. Anything that happens almost is going to have a legal ramification that has already been predefined by the deal. Secondly, both sides were negotiating under a tremendous amount of domestic political pressure. And that meant that both sides negotiated and took very maximalist positions in the early phases of the negotiations. And then it took quite some time to move away from those maximalist positions towards a more reasonable center.
This is Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN, online and on mobile. Get the ABC Radio app, free from Google Play and the App Store, and you can listen to Rear Vision or any other RN program anytime, anywhere, without using your mobile data. Today on Rear Vision, it's the story of the deal struck over Iran's nuclear program and how it might play out more widely in the Middle East. Iran and the P5+1 announced a comprehensive deal on the 14th of July. Here, the ABC's Norman Hermont summarizes the details of the 150-page agreement.
One of the key issues has been what to do with Iran's nuclear stockpiles. Much of the spent fuel will be moved to Russia. Before sanctions are lifted, there must be proof of compliance with the International Atomic Energy Agency, given unrestricted access to nuclear sites. As it stands, Iran has a large stockpile of enriched uranium and nearly 20,000 centrifuges. That's enough to create 8 to 10 nuclear bombs. The U.S. says Tehran is capable of having a bomb within 3 months. The number of centrifuges will be reduced to just over 6,000, and the activity undertaken at both of its uranium enrichment plants, Natanz and Fordo, will be limited. Iran's nuclear program will be confined to energy production, with any enriched uranium used only for industrial and medical use, peaceful purposes that Tehran insists has always been the case.
Since then, President Obama has managed to avoid having the agreement overturned in the US Congress, and Iran's parliament and supreme leader have approved it. 3 weeks ago, Iran and the P5+1 formally adopted the nuclear deal, and Iran began taking steps to restrict its nuclear program. Between now and implementation day, probably several months away, Iran must dismantle much of its nuclear program, decommissioning two-thirds of its uranium centrifuges and selling or diluting 96% of its stockpile of enriched uranium.
Parties agreed on things, but we still don't know how that implementation comes in. For instance, parties agreed that spent fuel will be shipped out of Iran, but they did not agree on who's going to get that spent fuel from Iran. It's likely that Russia will get it, but in the agreement it's not stated, so it will take time to agree on this. Plus, spent fuel is something really highly radioactive in nature, so it needs to be cooled down at least for 2 years. So for 2 years of a time it needs cooled down, it cannot be shipped. How this will happen, we don't know yet. So perhaps IAEA will put surveillance cameras over the spent fuel before shipment. The other challenge was actually the military sites of Iran, where IAEA and the negotiatory parties thought that there is nuclear clandestine activity going on. So they wanted to have the monitoring system there. Iran was saying that it was not going to allow any foreign country or agency to do an inspection in its military site. It's about national security. And there needs to be a concession made. So IAEA agreed that Iranian scientists will conduct the inspections and then give these tests to IAEA officials. And that's just been done in October, the first weeks of October.
In about 2 months or so, the International Atomic Energy Agency, a UN organization, will have to go to Iran and essentially confirm whether or not Iran has done what it is required to do through the agreement. for example, sending out the stockpile that it has or removing some of the centrifuges. On that day, when the confirmation comes by the IAEA, then the sanctions that the Europeans have promised to lift will actually be lifted, and effectively that will be the implementation day. Now, this is for the implementation of the agreement. Now, for years to come, the Iranian nuclear program will actually become part and parcel of a very robust inspection regime. Iran has agreed to adopt, at least voluntarily for now, what is called an additional protocol to the safeguard regime. And that means that the IAEA will be able to trace Iran's nuclear program from its inspection. That is to say, going to the uranium mines and effectively following through, for example, where that uranium goes. And in the process, will be able to tell the world on a regular basis that no part of Iran's nuclear program has been diverted towards a weapons program.
Where does Iran get its uranium from?
Well, Iran does have some uranium mines itself. So part of that uranium comes from Iran itself. A long time ago, Iran has also imported uranium, enriched uranium actually, from the outside. And Iran does have a research reactor that was actually built by the Americans many, many years ago. It used to be run by 90% enriched uranium many years ago, but then after the revolution, when the United States stopped replenishing that Tehran research reactor, the Iranians have bought enriched uranium, enriched at the level of 20% from Argentinians.
What can you tell us about lifting the sanctions?
You know, there are two types of sanctions. You know, some of them are sanctions that are nuclear related. And remember, this agreement essentially is a nuclear related. It does not make any promises regarding lifting of sanctions that are either related to terrorism, Iran being a state sponsor of terrorism, or human rights. So the sanctions that will be suspended are the ones that are nuclear related, and within the context of those sanctions, authority has been given to the President of the United States to suspend those sanctions based on American national security needs. So if the Iranian dynamics remains a contentious issue, we really do not know exactly how the current president and eventually the next president will address the antagonism that exists in the United States Congress and the desire to make sure that the president does not have the leeway to lift or suspend any of the sanctions in the future. So from my point of view, what will happen in the future is very much dependent on the implementation of this agreement in the future. If this agreement goes as planned and effectively reduces Iran's nuclear program or limits Iran's nuclear program, and there are no hitches involved in the process, then one can possibly expect opposition to any kind of agreement and lifting of sanctions in the future will be reduced. But if, for example, the Iran issue continues to be a hot issue in domestic American politics, and there might be pressures on Congress to actually impose more sanctions on Iran, then that would effectively undermine the agreement that has been reached, because part and parcel of the agreement that was reached is that the United States would not impose the sanctions that it imposed based on Iran's nuclear program under a different guise. So it would be United States that would be violating the terms of the agreement. It's a very tricky situation because this agreement, despite the fact that it was mostly negotiated between United States and Iran, it's actually a multilateral agreement. You have other players involved, the Europeans as well as China and Russia. And then if United States indeed is placed in a position of violating the agreement, then Iran will not feel obligated to follow through with its part of the agreement, and we are again in an uncertain territory.
Although here in Australia the media coverage has been focused on the Iran-US relationship, Pejman Abdolmohammadi says Iran is much more interested in improving ties with Russia and China.
Well, yes, in my opinion, Islamic Republic of Iran, ideologically on one hand and on the interest of alliance on the other hand, has much more interest to keep Beijing and particularly Moscow as on his side rather than to open in a real and proper way to Washington and Brussels. So that's, you know, a kind of strategical move that the Islamic Republic did and is doing in a very, very sophisticated way. You could see at the same time there is this opening to the nuclear talk, Iran is getting much, much closer to Russia. Iran and Russia, they are planning to opening a common bank. They are planning to have a much more financial and economic and infrastructural program together on one hand. And on the other hand, China's influence on Iranian economy is huge. And there is important tie between Iran and China. And also because the Islamic Republic is vulnerable on the civil rights question, they are not seeing any convenience to open a 100% to the West, because then they feel afraid and threat that this could become a kind of Gorbachev effect. The Islamic Republic knows very well the Gorbachev effect, and Rouhani is not going to become Gorbachev.
However, the establishment of a new relationship between the US and Iran has upset America's closest allies in the Middle East, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, and led to some unusual alliances.
The fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran started to go back and to become again, I don't say ally, because I don't see it as ally, but closer to the United States, it has been a revolutionary shifting inside of the Middle East, because before 79, Iran was the ally of the United States, the second pillar together with Israel. So after the shift of the system in Iran with the Ayatollah Khomeini's and Islamic Republic, Iran has never played anymore until now a kind of alliance or close relation with the United States. And this lack of the presence of Iran as a Western ally in the Middle East helped and somehow provoked and gave space to Saudi Arabia on one hand and Turkey on the other hand to grow their role and to become much more important in the Middle East in the last 30-35 years. So now that these two countries, they see coming back of Iran as a protagonist in the region and to become also closer to the United States administration, this of course threat them. Both Turkey and Saudi Arabia, they are not so much in favor of that. And of course, Israel too, because also Israel sees a coming back of Iran as a protagonist power under Islamic Republic, not strategically convenient. So you're going to have a new alliance, which is Israel, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and also maybe some other Arab countries of the Persian Gulf on one hand, that they are not actually natural ally, because Israel and Saudi Arabia, they are not natural ally. Geopolitically speaking, Israel and Iran, they are natural ally in the Middle East, but they are not now doing that because of the ideological reason for both system of politics that are on charge. So, of course, this created an edited alliance in Middle East, which could create a more tension that we have seen that in the case of Yemen, for example.
Iran is a stronghold of the Shia Muslim faith and is fighting a proxy war with Saudi Arabia, a Sunni Muslim country, in Yemen. There, Iran is backing the Houthis, Shia tribesmen. Iran supports President Bashar al-Assad and the Alawites in Syria and Hezbollah, also Shiites, in Lebanon. Iran also now has close ties with Iraq, where the majority Shia are politically dominant after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Robert Olson says that the relationship between the US and Iran, established through the nuclear deal, will be important given Iran's involvement in all these Middle East hotspots.
I think it will, but it's going to be a topsy-turvy kind of a relationship because of the issues that we just mentioned. But I think it's in Iran's interest to do so because of geopolitics. After all, they're dealing with China and India and Russia as well. But I think they will want to maintain their relations with the Alawi community in Syria, with the Hezbollah, the Shia community in Lebanon, certainly the Shia community in Yemen, and absolutely they will want to maintain this very strong relationship where they have the Shia in Iraq. I mean, there are 23 million Shia in Iraq, only 5 million Sunnis. That is in Arab Iraq, leaving the Kurds aside. That's almost 27, 28 million people. And they will want to maintain that. Whatever differences that may arise between Tehran and between Baghdad, they will maintain that. They're in a very strong position now, of course.
And you think that it will be in the U.S.'s interest to maintain a better relationship with Iran as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I do, yeah. Because you need Iran for relations in Iraq primarily. You need them for the Kurds in Iraq. I mean, you have 8 million Kurds in Iran. And now already, you know, there are many difficulties in Kurdistan, Iraq, and the Iran is increasing its support for the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the PUK, which increases differences with the Democratic Party of Barzani, who is aligned with Turkey. And so Iran is important for all of these issues. And of course, the situation in Syria is absolutely vital. Relations between Russia and between Iran are the dominant factor with regard to the Alawi regime. Of course, the United States is a major player too, but now we've seen as a result of the Russian invasion that the whole situation has become much more dicey, as we say, or much more tenuous. Yes, all these issues affect Iran, but the United States and Europe want to have Iran at least being a contributing member to trying to address some of these issues.
Well, I think that Syria, it's one of the most important cases now in the Middle East because it shows two important clashes on the regional level and on the global level. So you have it on the one hand, the Cold War between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which is becoming not anymore cold in Syria and Yemen. And on the other hand, you have a more global challenge between Washington and China and Russia. So Syria is the one of the last parts that it has been still under the influence of Russians. And this is also one of the reasons that Bashar Assad didn't fall easily, as it happened, for example, in Egypt and in Libya. And this is, you know, creating a very interesting, as you're saying, many players are in charge, and there is an interesting situation of changing alliance every month and every 2 or 3 months. I mean, we don't have a classic alliance situation now. We could say that we have some classic blockage, which is Iran, Russia on one hand and Bashar Assad. And on the other hand, you have Saudi Arabia, which felt threat by this strong alliance which is coming. And the fact that also Obama's doctrine is going somehow to be softer towards Iran. And certainly Saudi Arabia, I think that is trying to push as much as possible. It's more alliance with Israel, and because thinks that by influencing Israel, then they could somehow stop this new changing which is happening in Middle East. And on the other hand, the ISIS role is a threat for Saudi Arabia too, because ISIS is a really competitor of Saudi Arabia on the field of Sunni Islam and the orthodoxy of Sunni Islam. And we have to really see what is happening, but I don't see that at this moment something going to diminish the tensions. I see a great escalation coming.
Really? So you think it could become even more violent in the area?
Definitely, I think so, yeah.
Dr. Pejman Abdolmohammadi from the LSE. The other people you heard on Rear Vision were Robert Olson from the University of Kentucky, Trita Parsi, President of the National Iranian American Council, Faradeh Fahi from the University of Hawaii, and Beza Unal from Chatham House in London. Russell Stapleton is the sound engineer for Rear Vision today. I'm Keri Phillips. Thanks for listening.